91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we take you to pool school. No, not billiards, but the backyard variety. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Fun in the sun is a way of life in Florida, often with a pool at the heart of it. But if you don't pay for professional care, you'll need some basics. We'll speak with a former chemistry professor, Dr. Joseph Lorino, and learn about chemical safety, water quality, and dealing with leaks, and more. Linda Gastenheimer visits with Australian master chef Dan Churchill, a breakout celebrity foodie. He's written A Guy's Guide to Cooking. So, back soon. First, the news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman should be returning on Monday. Well, this hour we begin with an At Your Service segment. Our topic, residential swimming pools. A luxury or a curse? We have an expert on hand. He's Dr. Joseph Lorino. He's formerly a chemistry professor at the University of Tampa, and he now is the head of Periodic Products. We'll take your pool maintenance and repair calls at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Dr. Joseph Lorino, welcome to Topical Currents.
Thank you, Joseph.
Well, this time of year, pool use really increases, especially those which are unheated. So what's the first priority of the pool owner?
It's really safety, chemical safety of the pool, for both the bather and also equipment, to be able to maintain the equipment properly.
What kind of temperature do most people want? If you don't have a heated pool, and during February and March things got a little chilly, what temperature is the ideal to begin swimming?
Probably for the water temperature, people like it around 90 degrees. We don't like to have the water any higher than about 105.
But what's comfortable to go in? You say 90?
Well,
mine's at 85. And it's
people like it at 90, but I know people that go in at 75 or 80. But oftentimes, if you go to some of the condo associations, people there like to have it a little warmer. So typically we find out that people keep the temperature around 90.
Now, if you have a screen enclosure over your pool, about how much does that decrease the temperature of the water?
It doesn't really have that much of an impact on the water per se, especially because the ambient air temperature is usually very high. It does tend to keep some of the debris out of the pool, which makes the maintenance easier.
Now, concerning maintenance, should you do it? Should you learn how to do it, the homeowner, and do it yourself? Or is it best to have either weekly or bi-weekly service from the professionals?
It really depends how comfortable you are with the chemistry. If you do rely on a pool service, I would have it maintained at least once a week. And I would have a test kit to do testing of that water between that time, just in case something happens that you need to intervene and add some chemicals on your own.
At first it's kind of fun, but then it gets to be sort of a chore. So people let it slide?
Oftentimes, yes. When you have a pool, you should really test the water every day. Public pools actually test the water about every 2 to 4 hours. And sometimes they're actually tested, if you will, constantly. They have meters that monitor things like chlorine and pH and alkalinity and hardness. But generally, the requirements are for the public pool that they're tested every 2 to 4 hours.
Let's start especially with pool safety. And I guess the best place to begin would be is to make sure that young kids have no access to it from outside.
Yes. There should always be a fence around that pool to protect someone from going in that pool. There should be monitors.
Latches high on fences.
Latches high, and you should have window alarms so that and if you'll door alarms so that you know when somebody's going in and out of those egress areas to the pool. Some people like to have a monitor that's in the pool so that when someone goes in the pool, it actually alarms someone in the house that someone has gone in the pool.
And how much do those run? Are they hard to install?
They're not hard at all. You can buy them in any kind of pool store. We're not talking thousands of dollars, you're talking hundreds.
Well, if you have questions about pool repair or pool maintenance, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at number 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Sticking with safety, most pools also have an electrical element. Take us through that.
Okay. When you have water and you have
electricity and water don't mix,
you got to be very careful. For a freshwater pool, it's actually a little easier because you only have to worry about the metal. So any metal component in that pool has to be connected to each other through a copper wire. And that's to make it so the current will not flow through the metal pieces. And then those have to be grounded. So things like your light, your ladders, your pumps, your heaters, any kind of enclosure room that's metal needs to be grounded and bonded also. It's very important that the electrical components are kept out of the water. Now, when you look at salt water, unfortunately, salt water conducts electricity. So it makes the situation a little bit more, shall I say, precarious for the homeowner. They have to be very careful that their bond wire, this copper wire, is actually maintained.
Now, we don't see that wire. Where is it?
That wire extends 3 feet horizontally from the pool. It should anyway, and should connect to everything 12 feet above the pool that is in fact metal. It's a copper wire, oftentimes more than one, and it actually is buried. So it's very important when you, say, replace your decking on the pool, that you don't dig up this copper ground wire system. And if you do, you actually replace it. Also, if you were to replace a light, which people often have to do, you make sure that you connect all the wires, especially the ground wire. And you should probably hire someone to do that. I do not recommend homeowners do electrical work around their pool because of the problems associated with doing it wrong. They should hire somebody, but not only an electrician, but someone who is an electrician who's familiar with pools.
So if you moved into a house that has a pool, you might want to have somebody come out and check that those are grounded.
Absolutely.
Or if you own the pool and perhaps you've had a new deck put on.
Absolutely.
Check to make sure.
Absolutely.
They come out and they can test that with meters that there's potential.
Yes, they can come out and they can actually test that. But it's very important to actually make sure, if you don't know the history of that pool, that you have somebody come out who knows electricity to actually make sure that everything is sound with that pool.
Now, salt and freshwater pools, the difference is very obvious. But it's a completely different system of chlorination, correct?
Yes. Typically, the main way to chlorinate a pool, and why you do the chlorination, is because you have to disinfect. More than one bather uses that pool, so you want to disinfect that water of any kind of organic contaminants. So chlorine has been traditionally the way that is done. People often don't like chlorine, so they wanted to go to a way that they thought did not require chlorine. So they were sold systems that were salt systems. So they dump salt, sodium chloride, in their pool. And there's a little electrolytic generator, a little, if you will, chlorine generator by their pump that actually takes the salt and generates the chlorine. It's very low amounts, but it does in fact generate the chlorine. It also generates a base that we call it in chemistry, and that causes the pH to increase, and that causes a problem because chlorine isn't as active when the pH is higher. So they have to add acid to the pool, usually daily, if they want to keep the chemistry correct in that pool.
Now, liquid chlorine and tablet chlorine, which is best, or do you use both?
Liquid chlorine is only going to be chlorine. Chlorine is not stable with sunlight, so you have to put a stabilizer in. Cyanuric acid is the name that we give it. And the tablets contain the cyanuric acid. So the tablets, half of the 3-inch tablet is actually stabilizer. So you have a tendency, if you only use the 3-inch tablets, to overdo the stabilizer, which tends to reduce the effectiveness of the chlorine to do what it needs to do. So if you do use tablets, you should always use the liquid also, because you don't want the stabilizer level to get above 50 ppm, ideally. So, because the only way to get rid of the stabilizer is actually to dump the water out of the pool. So you don't want to get to the point where it locks the chlorine and doesn't make it effective. So you
it can, won't just diminish in time?
No.
Not at all.
Not at all. It stays there. So you...
That's a major undertaking.
That's there. A major undertaking, right? And it's a major issue because people have used the 3-inch tablets for so long. So once it gets above 100, you need to really dump the water out of the pool, or at least dump some of the water out of the pool to actually lower that level, because chlorine can't do its job then.
We're speaking with Dr. Joseph Lorino. We're talking about swimming pools here in South Florida. We're at your service. When we come back, we'll take a few of your phone calls as well. And it is today's Topical Currents at your service edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman will be back with us on Monday. We resume our conversation with Dr. Joseph Lorino. He heads the Periodic Products Company. And we're talking pool maintenance, and we're taking your calls. 1-800-743-9576. First up, we have Michael in Hollywood. Hi there.
Hi.
Can you speak up?
You hear me?
There we go.
Okay. Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Thank you, Dr. Lorino and Mr. Cooper, for taking my call. I am calling because we are looking at purchasing a house, and the house was built in the 60s, and it's possible the pool might be that old, too. And I was wondering what sort of problems I could be inheriting. I already knew the pool has been painted, and it has to be resurfaced, and there's separation between the lip of the pool and the patio, and I was wondering if these are all things that should really give me some big red flags.
Well, I would definitely hire an engineer to come out and to look at the plaster. The main part of the pool is actually a shell. It's actually a gunite shell, and on that surface, you actually put the plaster and also the tile. And then the decking is actually separate from that. So as long as the shell is good, the rest of it's cosmetic.
So okay, you can get that expert if you go to your local pool professional?
You should go to a local pool store and ask them. They should have a list of people that can come out and do the they'll actually take a look at the shell, they'll look at the steps, and they'll determine whether or not you need to get further investigation. They'll also do a leak test.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. And how long is the average life of a pool?
In general, your cement shell will probably last you around 50 years.
Okay, that's not a good number.
Okay, well, Good luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
We have an emailer here, Kevin. He says, we noticed a white film. It's apparently calcium buildup on the tiles and on the bottom and around the pool. We have the pool stable and have the chemicals, and according to my home test kit, we're good. So will the calcium go away on its own, or is it something I need to hire a professional to remove, or is it something I can do?
Hey, the white staining is actually calcium, and it's a very common problem when you have hard water. You also have to put calcium in the pool to maintain the pool surface. So when you start to get scaling like that, we tend to say that, you know, the calcium is too high. There's no real way to pull out your calcium. So the best thing you could do is treat that by hiring someone to come in, and they can actually remove the calcium scale off of the tile using a chemical.
Okay. He also adds, on a side note, for years we had pool service, but really haven't been satisfied with the effort. So we recently took on doing the pool work ourselves, and it's been rewarding to do the work ourselves and to have our kids involved in maintaining the pool that they love to swim in. So that sounds like a good idea.
It does.
And we'll move along to Henry. Henry in Miami. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon from Miami, Florida. Thank you, and thank your guests for taking my call. Would like to ask your guest, so now you have chlorine to be concerned about, then you have the pH to be concerned about, then you have the acidity of the water to be concerned about. Is there a manual test that the consumer can go out and go and purchase in the pool store, and maybe I take control of the test maybe on a daily basis or every 2 or 3 days, rather than the automated machinery where all these chemicals are controlled by automation? That's kind of like my first question. And my second, I have a family member that uses the bouncing canister with the three chlorine tablets, and while away for several weeks, he told me to take care of the pool and to replace the tablets. Now, I know you spoke about it, and I got into your show almost mid, but it's an interesting topic because we have a family member that does have the pool. And when should that all cycle of maintenance be done? This pool is, oh, by the way, it also has a jacuzzi. So he's replaced the pump system and everything, but I don't know how he does his maintenance as far as chlorine and all the other chemicals that are associated to pool maintenance. And I'd like to take your response while I hang up and listen to the radio.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for the question. In terms of the pool chemistry, you really have to keep the water, we call it balanced. And to do that for testing, you want to test chlorine, and you want to test both free and total chlorine. You want to test your pH, you want to test alkalinity, and you want to test hardness. You want to do the chlorine, the pH, once a day. You want to do the alkalinity and the hardness at least once a week. And then you want to test for the stabilizer, cyanuric acid, once a week. If you buy a test kit at the store, you should be able to get all of those tests available. The other thing you could do is bring in a sample of water to the pool store. Many of them will actually do the test for you for free. The other test I would recommend is actually metals, to test your pool for copper and also for iron. And so if you have those metals in the pool, it could cause you problems with staining.
How about chlorine for the do-it-yourselfer? Should they attempt to transport those in their own vehicles, or will the pool store deliver them?
I don't know if they will actually deliver them to residential homes, commercial establishments. They will. You can buy a liner for your car trunk to put these plastic containers.
Because if you got rear-ended with those things in your trunk,
it would be a
disaster.
It would be a problem, but I would say that if you're going to take care of your own pool, you're going to have to lug those jugs around. There's really no other way to do it.
And that chlorine is much stronger than Clorox.
Yes, that chlorine is stronger than Clorox. Now, the powdered chlorine is also something that you have to be very careful of. It's also a chemical. It's a very strong oxidizer. So you have to make sure you don't mix that with other things in your garage or in your home. Because it will oxidize. It will oxidize anything. So you got to be very careful. So keep it away from gasoline, paints, and those types of things.
Now, something that's quite counterintuitive, when somebody gets out of the pool and they hold their nose and it's, ooh, it stinks like chlorine. There's too much chlorine. It's actually not enough?
Right. The smell that you smell is actually a chemical which is called chloramine. And it's that amine smell, that fishy smell.
Like ammonia.
Like ammonia that you actually smell. And what that tells you is that's actually a byproduct of the chlorine reacting with an organic material. So if you have that smell, it means that you have to add chlorine to your pool.
And let's go back to our calls. Dan in Aventura, hi.
Oh, hi, Joe. Thanks for taking the call. Doctor, my question is really related to a health one, I guess. And, I'm not a scientist, but I agree there's only two kinds of science, good science and junk science. I love swimming, but I have to say in about the past year or so, I've rarely gone in the pool anymore. I live in a condo, not a fancy one, but they take good care of the pool. And, I read all this stuff about chlorine, and I did get headaches occasionally after swimming. So my main point is this. We know, and I've read many times in Europe for many years, not only have they gone to ozone for their water systems in general to drink, but, of course, all their pools. And even in this country, I believe the Olympic pools and special swimming is done in ozonated pools. So that's my main question. I, from what I've read, Doctor, would definitely, beyond a doubt, prefer ozone. I know it's more expensive, so I'd like your thoughts on that whole general switching over to, let's say, an ozonated pool or whatever you call it versus a chlorinated pool.
Thank you for the question. It's actually a really good one. Ozone is great. Ozone is generated by the a machine that is actually put close to the pump. It does destroy organic material, and it's really good at actually knocking out the chloramines and any kind of other organic products that are in your pool. The problem with ozone is that it doesn't have a residual, which means that it only kills what it sees and it doesn't end up in the pool. And you want to have a residual disinfectant in that pool. Because if somebody goes in that pool, you want to kill whatever they may have put in that pool organic-wise. So you want to have the residual, number one. Number two, in order for ozone to be a primary disinfectant, you'd have to use such a high level that it would not be safe. So the best system is to use chlorine with also an ozone generator. And that will allow you to lower the level of the chlorine required, reduce your maintenance, and kill the byproducts.
Is that feasible for a homeowner, though?
It is feasible for a homeower.
Okay. All right, Dan, thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, thank you very much, Doctor. Okay. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your call. And we're short on time, but let's go to Saul in Miami. Again, I am short on time, Saul. Hi. Saul, you're up.
Hello. This is Saul. Am I on?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your call, for taking the call. I have a structural question on a pool that I would like to ask. I have an old pool. It has a couple of holes that are showing through the structural steel at the bottom of the pool. And I have contacted a repair person, and basically they're telling me that they would need to cut through the steel in order to then replace it with a hydrostatic cement and then top it off with the Marvelite. I'm curious to find out if that's sounds like an appropriate way to patch a hole. The hole is about 8 inches in diameter.
I would think that that's actually fairly good advice, given the situation you have.
Okay, thanks very much for your call. Unfortunately, we're out of time and we barely scratched the surface. I want to thank Dr. Joseph Lorino. He is the head of Periodic Products. Briefly, what's that about?
It's a company that actually created plastic materials to take metals out of water. So it's used in mining and EPA applications. We also sell products for the pool industry in terms of taking out chemicals and metals out of your pool.
That's very interesting. We certainly want to thank you, Dr. Joseph Lorino, for helping us out here on Topical Currents at Your Service. And Food and Dining up next. And we return 34 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman is out. She has some family matters, but we expect Bonnie to be back on Monday. Well, Thursday has arrived. So too has chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. Of course, she'll have a dinner in minutes a little bit later in our segment. And also, Linda has another celebrity chef with us.
Certainly do. This is one for you, Joseph Cooper.
Oh, why is that?
Okay. Well, first I want to ask people, do your guys ever take dinner duty? I'm talking about your son, your husband, or your significant other. Well, our guest is going to help them on their way, and he's Dan Churchill.
Or do they do the most of the cooking?
Well, Joe, you keep telling me, but I don't
know.
Yeah, right. Well, you haven't proven it to me,
okay?
So there you go. So Dan Churchill is a physical trainer with degrees in sports exercise management, and also he's a breakout chef for MasterChef Australia. Wait till you hear him, you'll know he's from Australia. His book is Dude Food, and he's here to give us some tips on how to conquer the kitchen. Let's welcome Dan Churchill.
Hey guys, how are you going?
Oh, he comes on laughing. That's good.
Yeah,
that's
right.
A good sign.
It's just funny when you hear people talking about you. It's I don't know. It's humbling, but at the same time, it's still strange. But I love it. It's funny.
All right.
She was showing pictures, also.
Yes.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. They're on the web. You go to my website, dinnerandminutes.com. You'll see the pictures. Well, we've heard. We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Also, do you have some tips, or maybe how to get your ultra dude into the kitchen? Give us some call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. And Joe, we do have email today.
Radio@WLRN.org.
Okay. Also with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns. And you can also read Fred's wine column in the Saturday Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, it turns out that we have dude food, so the question is there such a thing as dude wine?
I'm sure you found some, Fred. Let's go to Dan Churchill. Dan Churchill, ultimate dude, physical trainer, loved to surf. So how did you go from surfing to the kitchen?
Yeah, look, okay, so I'm fortunate to grow up on the northern beaches of Sydney, and I kind of got involved in cooking because my family used to sit down and watch Jamie Oliver, do his thing on The Naked Chef, and that was when I was about 12 years old. And then Dad, the genius that he is, he likes to develop, life skills. So he came up with the concept of, well, we're all enjoying cooking, at least watching it, so why don't I put a roster together? So we had like a timetable, and the timetable was, Monday would be, Dan, Tuesday would be Andrew, Wednesday would be Brendan, and so on and so forth.
He sounds like a very smart man.
Yeah,
get
but don't
you
tell
all
him.
Working.
Don't tell him. I don't want to make his head too big.
Well, I want to ask you, I was interested to see that your guy's book is not all steak and potatoes. And you have a chapter on sandwiching the gym. You say that going to the gym is pointless if you don't consume the right nutrients around your workout. So what should we be eating before and after?
Yeah, great question. Well, I mean, the first thing is I designed the book not to be based around breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I wanted to be very guy-centric. So that's why I have things like sandwiching the gym, how to impress a girl, the hangover cure. But in terms of your question, food is a big part of our life. It makes us super happy. It brings us all together. But also in times, obviously, it's very nourishing and it plays a role in looking after ourselves. When you go to the gym and you work out or you run or whatever it is, you're breaking down muscle fiber. So you actually you tear the muscle fibers apart. That's what happens when you actually do a contraction. And you need relevant and ready-to-go protein and necessary carbohydrates and micronutrients available to repair that damaged tissue, because that's the benefit you get from the exercise you're doing. So when you get sore after going to the gym, it's not a bad thing. It's actually your body telling you it's repairing. And in order to do the repairing process, you're going to need the protein and necessary carbohydrates available, readily available, for the adaptation.
So what should we be eating?
Great question. Well, to be honest, I don't like to make it really specific because everyone's different in terms of what they're eating. So I always say if you look down at your plate and it's full of colour and it's got a bit of protein, so a fistful of protein, so whether it be meat, chicken, fish, then you're doing really well. And that's particularly important within, you know, 40 minutes after your training session. So I think prior to, you're going to need a lot of relevant carbohydrates, whether it be your brown rice, your smoothies, your fruit, things like that that are complex but are really good for you in slow-release carbohydrates. Oats are particularly important. There's actually a recipe called Breakfast on the Go in Dude Food that's particularly important for pre-game workouts or pre-game meals. And then afterwards, if you can get, you know, some sort of vegetables, plenty of green, tasty vegetables with, you know, some sort of meat involved into your intake, that's ideal for a post-workout meal.
Okay. Well, then the other point you make I thought was interesting was that you mentioned the timing of our meals is important. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. So, I mean, food's always number one in our lives as a taste. I don't want to break it down as to something that we use for fueling our body. If you don't like it, don't eat it. But in terms of timing, you have this thing called your glycolytic window, which is within about 20 to 25 minutes of your workout. So post-workout, this window is where you can get maximal benefit and from your workout. So if you go past that, it's like generally when all your cellular functionings and all those kind of internal states are really optimally performing, and so the messengers are going to and fro from your brain, the interaction between your muscles and the nervous system working really well. So within that 30-minute period post-workout, it's where it's a good chance for you to get the nutrients in for them to really optimize on the adaptation ability. So that's why people have protein shakes, because it's just really convenient post-workout to get something in before you have a meal, because sometimes, you know, it's hard to get home and within that 30 minutes have something to eat, or you may be at work, or, you know, you may be away from some sort of kitchen. So, I mean, that's why I put the chocolate banana protein shake in the...
So you're talking about that's after a workout, but can we have our... I was kind of confused. I mean, do we have our three meals a day when we're supposed to have them, or are there certain foods we should eat at certain times of the day as opposed to other times?
Well, if I told you when you were gonna when you're gonna have to eat, how would you respond? Like if I told you when you know what I mean?
Listen, I eat all day, so whatever.
Look, with food, it's important. If you're hungry, you eat. If you're not, I don't want to make people feel like they have to eat at some time. If you ever have to do anything, you're not going to enjoy it completely, and that's the whole point about food. Food is so enjoyable. When it comes to eating, yeah, you should try and have 3 to 4 meals a day, realistically. So if that, like, I'd like to see people start eating as soon as they get up, purely because that starts the metabolism. But that's me. Some people get up and they really can't stomach it. So I'm not going to force them to say that this is what you have to do. And that's the same with, at nighttime. You should be looking realistically at foods that are going to be lower in carbohydrates, higher in quality fats and proteins, because you're going to be pretty sedentary after you eat. You generally, you know, you watch TV, you read a newspaper, whatever it is, you go to bed. So you're not going to be very active, and you don't want to be sitting with all this high-performance energy in your system, which is just going to, you know, be stored and obviously turn into things you don't want to.
So in other words, cut back a little bit at night because you're going to be sleeping on it.
Correct.
And eat a little more during the day when you need the energy. All right, so I want to go to a little different subject here, because we've been talking about all this healthy food, but however, people may know that today is National Hamburger Day.
It is.
Yes.
It is.
And you've got a bro burger.
You know it.
Now Joe Cooper's perking up, okay? So what makes a bro burger?
What makes a bro burger? Well, I love the bro burger because it is one of the most popular dishes that's been cooked out of dude food, but also it just brings out the natural personality of every single person who goes to eat it. There's no hiding the fact it's messy, it's super tasty, but I guess it's a little cleaner than your typical hamburger, but it's just, it's amazing. So it's made up of a really nice homemade chutney, tomato chutney. It's got an aioli that I teach you to make as well, but you don't have to.
So an aioli is a garlicky mayonnaise.
Oh, you're good. You're very good. Yes, yeah, so it's garlic mayonnaise.
And then what do you put in it?
So the basis of any mayonnaise is some egg yolks, some Dijon mustard, salt, and then you whisk in some oil progressively, and then you add some lemon juice at the end until it becomes emulsified. With a garlic aioli, you add in the garlic at that base point when you added in your Dijon mustard. Okay. And I like to actually roast garlic now as well. So if you roast your garlic and then squeeze out that tender flesh that's in the inside, it just adds a next level sweetness that is just unbelievable to the burger. So,
and then what else goes into the aioli? Is that what goes, just the mayonnaise alone on the burger?
Oh, and so you got in the aioli itself, you've got lemon zest, salt, pepper, and the aioli, then the oil itself, and that brings it all together and just makes it this amazingness. So have you ever had a mayonnaise aioli before?
I've always made mine, and I make it, you can also make it in the food processor and all of that. But then you put tomatoes into that to make the chutney?
And the chutney is separate, yeah. So I make it's essentially making your own tomato-based sauce. So you add...
Oh, so that's separate from the mayonnaise. Okay,
that's
great.
Correct. Yeah. Right. So the tomato chutney is, you roast off tomatoes. I select Roma, but you can just whatever's, you know, in season around your local supermarket. With some hard herbs like rosemary and thyme and some, again, some garlic. I'm going to feel sorry for my future girlfriend or wife, whoever that is, because I love my garlic.
Well, I know you because you have a chapter on how to get out of the doghouse.
That's a recipe, but yeah,
this is not a recipe for helping you with the doghouse, right?
It's definitely not. But yeah, that's another thing. If you're ever in trouble, my man, if you're ever in trouble, make sure you, I think it's page 125 on Dude Food. It is a shortbread base with a chocolate raspberry ganache, and this has actually been proven by my mates back home in Australia. If you are in trouble, make this dish, and you will get plenty of smiles, a hug, and you don't have to say you're sorry because the dish does it for you.
All right. Well, I think on that delicious note, we're going to take a break. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Dude Food author Dan Churchill. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with breakout chef from MasterChef Australia and Dude Food cookbook author Dan Churchill. He's been giving us tips for guys to get into the kitchen, and also he's been giving us some eating tips, some healthy eating tips, especially around our workout. And we're going to talk to him about cutting calories pretty soon, but right now it's dinner in minutes time. So today's dinner is a real simple dinner that dudes can make. It's a easy dude dinner. And it's a quick roast pork with sweet and spicy dry rub and some hot pepper succotash. Now, the dry rub is made with ground cumin, coriander, cayenne pepper, and a little brown sugar. And you just mix that all together, and the heat is up to you. If you want more cayenne pepper, then put it in. Spray the pork tenderloin with some olive oil spray and put the spices onto the surface. Press it in. And then I broil it about 6 inches from the heat for 10 minutes and turn it over in another 5 minutes. Now, it's real simple these days. You only need a meat thermometer, and it should read 145 degrees for your pork to be done. So while the pork is cooking and it's broiling, warm a little chicken broth in a skillet, and I add some frozen corn kernels, some lima beans, and then some hot pepper jelly. So this is a hot and spicy meal. And then I sprinkle it with some scallions. Now, if you want that whole recipe, the complete recipe, it's at dinnerinminutes.com with a photo. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, you teased us with some dude wine earlier on.
Yeah, Dan, for this show, Linda asked me if there's such a thing as dude wine, and of course there is. I mean, if you think cooking is the way to a woman's heart, imagine what you can accomplish when you add a bottle or three of good wine.
A bottle or three, okay.
A bottle or three. So, yeah. Dudes, you've got to know something about wine. And if you don't, here's how to start. Now, take notes, because there will be a quiz later, a quiz called Life. Okay, how to be a wine dude. Step one, from the beginning, buy the excellent basic wine book called Windows on the World Complete Wine Course. It's by wine experts Kevin Zraley, spelled Z-R-A-L-Y. And it's $29 on Amazon.com and other websites. Very easy to find. And it's the best first book on wine that I've seen.
Is that a new book, Fred?
He's been putting out
books for years.
Yeah, 20. Yeah. He comes out with a new book, updating it every couple of years, and it's just excellent. Yeah.
Yeah, he's very good.
Okay, so to start, you can pick just a couple of wines, say a California Merlot red wine and a California Chardonnay white wine, and just read all the information on those two wines in Zraley's book, and you'd be ready for your first date. And then you can fill in the gaps later. And of course, you just follow the rule for starters, that is, white wine with white meat and red wine with red meat. Next, and this is very important, find a local wine shop and make friends with the manager. Tell him what you're doing and kind of enlist him in your little plot to win the girl's heart. And then you ask him to guide you step by step in what you choose, starting with that Merlot and the Chardonnay.
I hope Dan is taking notes here, not for his guys. Dan, are you?
100%. Don't you worry. I'm all over it. That particular one, that last one with the getting to know your shopkeeper, that one, I can tell you this much, it is a big hand of a help. I can tell you that much.
Okay, Fred?
Now, one thing that's important is to take notes when you're talking to your wine merchant. Then when you pour that glass of Merlot for your dinner date or that glass of Chardonnay, you can casually mention something about it. Say it scored 95 points in the Wine Spectator or something. But don't overdo this, because then they'll think you're a wine snob, and that'll take away all the benefit that you've gained. Now, if you're taking her to a restaurant, this is a little bit of work. First, Google the wine list, or even go there in person if you have to, if it's an important date, and pick out in advance a Merlot and a Chardonnay in the price range that you want. And then when the dinner date happens, you can choose quickly and confidently and make yourself look like a real wine dude. Now, after that, every time you use Dan's good advice to cook a meal for your new squeeze at home or take her to a new restaurant, use Zraley's book and your wine merchant to bone up on two new wines, maybe a Sauvignon Blanc and a Chianti or something like that. By the time 6 months have passed and she turns fickle and kicks you to the curb, you'll already have a solid base of wine knowledge with which to impress the next woman you meet, maybe even more successfully. And pretty soon, you'll be confidently picking out the champagne for your wedding. Now, true, this is a lot of work, but as I always say, the homework is a lot more fun than it was back in algebra class.
Dan, do you give dude wine advice to your mates?
You know what, I've had to do it plenty of times, and I always keep it real basic and simple for them to understand. But, I mean, those tips are fantastic. What I always say is, You want something that's not going to overpower the dish, but complement it. So I always say, you know, obviously start out with red meat, and I always say go a nice summery white wine with the fish and in those kind of instances. But the biggest thing I always say to them is, if you've ever got any issues, just always go speak to the gentleman or lovely lady at the counter, because they're going to be the ones with the most understanding of the wines that they have in stock and sale. So, but it's funny, I've had a night where I've got a text from a mate saying, I've got the wine that you recommended, I've cooked the steak, if anything goes wrong, it's all on you.
Well, that's quite a responsibility.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to know that they're still together after 3 years. So
you've got to instill a little confidence in them, yeah.
That's right.
All right, well, we have a caller who's been waiting. Steve in Boca Raton, thanks for waiting. You're on air.
Hi, guys. Great show. I just wanted to get your thoughts on my philosophy for breakfast sometimes, that I tend to deviate from the traditional sense at times, where many times, not just for me, but for my kids, I'll feed my kids and myself vegetables, carrots, cucumber for breakfast, even a turkey burger at times.
Well, I'm surprised that your kids are eating vegetables. That's a major start right there.
they love vegetables. They love broccoli. And so I know most people think, you know, oatmeal and eggs for breakfast. We do that also, but just wanted to get your thoughts on it. I'll listen to it off the air.
Thank you. Dan, vegetables for breakfast.
I'm all for it. If you can get your kids to eat veggies, you're killing it, mate. That's awesome. As I said, there is no rules to cooking. There is no rule to eating. Whatever you enjoy, whatever's easiest for you, whatever works, do it. I mean, where did this understanding we had to have oats or toast or whatever it was for breakfast start? You know, there's no real governing point. But what I think's fantastic is that you're kind of deviating away from that, but still showcasing how it still works. I mean, I'm always saying get up in the morning and have something. If I told you to get up and have oats, your kids may not like that because they're so used to veggies, they prefer it that way. And so, you know, if it's a turkey burger, then so be it. Do what works for you. And we all have different distractions, you know, likes, beliefs, dislikes, but just always do what works for you. And I'm actually quite inspired by what you've done with your kids. That's fantastic.
You know what's interesting? He's taken the question. He's listening on air on the radio now. But he's what I'd like to know is he needs to write a book on how he gets his kids to eat vegetables.
Yeah, that's a great one, isn't it? The tricks.
I mean, that's very, very major. Mm. Well, Fred Tasker was talking about wine. You know, one or three bottles. So I'm looking at your chapter on a hangover cure. So what's your hangover cure?
Okay, now this is my hangover cure is I'm probably less traditional in the sense a lot of people go the whole greasy route. I have this porridge that I have right now that's it's made up of quinoa. It's a healthier grain, and I combine it with some coconut milk because for me I can't do dairy when I'm hungover, but I also don't like something greasy, so I make a coconut quinoa porridge, and that's on my YouTube channel as well. But in this book, the one that I am known for is definitely the French toast. It's phenomenal. It definitely makes a few people smile even though they're struggling with their headache. But you know, the thing about a hangover is everyone has their own preferences, just like any food. So whether you want the greasy start to the day or you want something sweet, I guess the hangover cure chapter in the Dude Food book has got your back for sure.
Right. And I also like the fact that you also give cooking tips, and that things like, do you remember food cooked in the oven continues to cook when you bring it out? So if you wait for it absolutely cooked in the oven, then when you bring it out, be well done. What's another tip you have for us?
Yeah, look, I think things like everyone talks about salt and how it's important in cooking, and it is. It brings out the natural flavor of an ingredient. It doesn't add flavor. It draws out the moisture. And when you've got moisture and flavor in something and you draw out the moisture, you're left with concentrated flavor. So that's what that's, you know, present for. But what we neglect...
But we only have a few seconds left, so...
The most important thing is acidity. So lemon juice, rice wine vinegar, always make sure, you know, red wine vinegar, you add that to your dish. So it lengthens the flavor on the palate. It makes sure the flavor lasts.
Well, instead of salt, that's a great tip. Well, thank you, Dan Churchill, for joining us and for the wonderful information.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. His book is Dude Food. It's a fun read, and it's full of very good information. Fred Tasker, thanks for your great advice.
Always a pleasure.
Joseph Cooper, great talking with you.
And you too, as usual.
Oh, next week, we'll be talking about a new type of food delivery service called Instacart. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for joining us today. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives for download at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, we have more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. See links, photos, and more discussion. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. We return Monday with an At Your Service program about selecting and using a contractor. Our advisor is the contractress, Kia Ritchie. She's the author of Taking the Con Out of Contracting. This is Joseph Cooper. For Linda Gassenheimer and Fred Tasker, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.